You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. Coming to you live from Studio One, I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, from the situation in Jerusalem to a Ukrainian rebel leader who's challenged President Poroshenko to a duel, Nina Schick and Daniela Peled discuss the news of the day. We'll also review new plays and musicals with the theatre critic Matt Wolfe. Get ready for this.
Where it's snowing all winter through.
And we meet the contemporary British artist Stuart Semple, who's turned his attention to the anxiety of his own generation. All that, plus we check in with our correspondent in Rio de Janeiro. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world. Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Israel has approved the construction of 78 new homes in two settlements on West Bank territory, annexed to Jerusalem. The Municipal Planning Committee has authorised 50 new housing units in Har Homa and Ramotas. The move is likely to aggravate Palestinian anger at a time when violence has flared. Two Palestinians killed four rabbis and a policeman on Tuesday at a Jerusalem synagogue in the worst attack in the city since 2008. There's been unrest in the past few weeks over access to Jerusalem's most sacred and politically sensitive site, Temple Mount, important to both Jews and Muslims. Meanwhile, an Israeli court has extended the remand of a Palestinian accused of stabbing to death a soldier by six more days. Police say the suspect was a Palestinian man from the Askar refugee camp at Nablus in the West Bank, who entered Israel illegally and attacked the soldier near a Tel Aviv railway station. The man's lawyer, Leah Tzemel, says his actions were those of a desperate man.
It's the same old story that didn't change for the last years of the occupation. A young person looks for his future, cannot really find it, and then decides, as an accumulation of all different reasons, to go and hit a soldier. That's it.
Four people have been sentenced to death in a court in Pakistan for beating to death a pregnant relative who'd married without their consent. 30-year-old Farzana Parveen was attacked with sticks and bricks in May outside Lahore's High Court. Police have rejected claims they did not intervene. Ms. Parveen's father, brother, cousin and former fiancé have all been found guilty of murder. Another brother was jailed for 10 years. Two men have been arrested after Honduras beauty queen Maria José Alvarado and her sister were found dead nearly a week after disappearing. The 19-year-old and her 23-year-old sister, Sofia Trinidad, vanished on Thursday after being seen leaving a party near the northern city of Santa Barbara. Police say both women were shot and their bodies buried in a field by a river. Ms. Alvarado had been due to compete in the Miss World contest in London. Heavy snow has been falling on western New York State, prompting a state of emergency. The freezing temperatures are believed to have contributed to the deaths of five people on the coldest November morning across the country since 1976. Weather experts say such cold weather is not usually seen until late December. Parts of Buffalo have received a record 193 centimetres of snow, while parts of Erie County have had 1.5 metres of snow, with more falling. US President Barack Obama is reported to be preparing to use his executive authority to provide work permits for up to 5 million people who live in the United States illegally. US media say the president's proposal could shield millions of people from deportation. Mr. Obama is expected to unveil his plan for immigration reform on Friday in Las Vegas. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson says he's satisfied the reforms are within existing legal authority.
They will address a number of things, including border security. The president is committed to border security. The president is committed to reducing illegal migration in the future. And so we'll be announcing a set of comprehensive reforms, all within our existing legal authority, to fix the broken immigration system.
Scientists say Comet 67P lander Philae sniffed organic molecules containing carbon, the basis of life on Earth, before its main battery ran out. Staff at Germany's Aerospace Centre in Cologne say it's not yet clear whether the carbon is part of complex compounds that make up proteins. Philae landed on the comet after a 10-year journey aboard the Rosetta spacecraft, on a mission to unlock details about how planets and maybe even life evolved. The lander was shut down at the end of 57 hours' work on the comet's surface on Saturday, after radioing back data from a series of experiments. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. That means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Ian Schick from the Open Europe think tank. Welcome both to the programme. Well, let's start with the icy relations between Russia and the West, which is prompting Russia to look for new friends. Russia and China pledged to develop closer military cooperation during the Russian defence minister's visit to Beijing recently. And he also announced that Russia and China are to hold joint military exercises in order to counter US influence. At the same time, President Putin has been calling for deeper ties with North Korea. Meanwhile, a top advisor to the Russian president has said that the Kremlin wants a 100% guarantee that Ukraine will not be allowed to join NATO. Nina, let's start with you. Do you think that he's looking in the right place for new friends? Because what's interesting is, you know, China may on paper say lots of things and be willing for trade agreements, etc., etc., but actually they want trade with the West as well. That's their bigger trading partner, not Russia.
I think this has long been a policy of Putin's, and that's become, you know, decisively clear as this crisis has developed, that he doesn't want to bow down to the so-called tyranny of the West, and particularly the US. That's why it's interesting that he's kind of said that they'll have closer ties with North Korea specifically as well. You know, that's certainly kind of putting two fingers up at the US, and recently Russia has been very strong about how they won't, you know, be subdued by the US, etc. But as you mentioned, on paper, when it comes to the actual economics of it, you know, Russia still has the most important trade links are all with the EU. And this crisis has developed, however, we've seen that the economy isn't Putin's primary motivator. So I think we'll continue to see these kind of new kind of alliances being built. But China will certainly be hesitant in how far they go, because they're also aware of their trading links with the rest of the world.
Daniela, we know we have a kind of multipolar world already, that, you know, it's not everything runs through DC these days. But, you know, do you think that the engineering that Putin is trying to do, that he can kind of gain more relevance for himself? Because when you look at it, you know, North Korea isn't exactly the most exciting friend to have made.
I think with North Korea, I think it's a large degree of sort of grandstanding and saying, you know, fingers up for you, the West. But certainly Putin is looking around the region for more opportunities. And I think we do tend to have a little bit of a narrow focus, seeing Europe and America as the, you know, as a passage for all trade. I mean, Russia has been pushing forward with its own economic union for quite a while now, and it's pushing more and more, involving Kazakhstan and other regional powers. And it's going to have a lot of leverage there. I think the party that would benefit more from this is North Korea. I mean, is there a more friendless country in the world? And not just a matter of friends. I mean, if you only have interests in international relations, not that many interests either. I mean, China is withdrawing a little from North Korea's chilly embrace. So I think North Korea stands to benefit more from Russian ties than the other way around.
Nina, do you feel that, in a way, though, the West has to be careful here? Because, you know, one of these things that we've just mentioned is, you know, that they're saying, look, we need a cast iron guarantee that you're not going to try and incorporate Ukraine into NATO. And when you're sitting in the West, that doesn't seem a kind of a very fair thing to say. You think every country should have a right to decide what it wants to do. But there is a sense in which the Russians do feel a little bit cornered, and they look at a country that was traditionally part of their sphere of influence. Do you think that the West also has to be a bit careful how it plays its cards here?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's been one of the strongest criticisms of the EU and their entire handling of the crisis. I mean, this all started because the EU and Russia were fighting over which trading union, which trading bloc, either the EU or the Russian trading bloc, the Ukraine would join. Now, at the time, the EU was putting a lot of pressure on the Ukraine that they couldn't have, you know, they couldn't be in both blocs. They either had to choose the EU or Russia, which led to the protests in Kiev, which now has led to this situation. So retrospectively, a lot of EU leaders themselves are coming out and saying, you know, that wasn't wise, especially because their end goal for Ukraine was never clear. It was, I mean, now EU leaders have come out and said, oh, well, it's clear that Ukraine won't join NATO, Ukraine won't be an EU member. So Ukraine has been kind of put in this halfway house situation where it gets the worst of both worlds from the EU and Russia, and to the devastating effect of the country. I mean, it's going down economically. It's only going to get worse. The IMF has already said they're going to need another bailout. And as long as the situation doesn't stabilize, you know, the long-term prospects for Ukraine continue to look very grim.
Danny, the same question to you. Do you feel the West has misplayed its hand?
Well, one thing I find alarming is that the conflict seems to be a bilateral one increasingly between NATO and Putin. I mean, this seems to be the biggest amount of conflict, the most amount of grandstanding, the most amount of rhetoric. But I think your areas of influence isn't the same as supporting a military upheaval in a country to whatever extent. I mentioned Kazakhstan before. Well, there are plenty of ethnic Russians in the north of Kazakhstan. But that doesn't mean that Kazakhstan is not exploring other relations and diplomatic and economic relations apart from Russia, which is an ally, a very important ally, but not the only ally. So I would bend more to the idea of countries being able to choose their own allegiances.
And the Russians have to cope with the fact because, you know, the Baltic states are members of NATO and sit right on their borders. So, you know, unless they're going to kind of go back into Latvia, which again has a huge Russian population, if you follow the logic of the Russians' argument, it does make you a bit concerned what would happen in the Baltics to either of you.
I mean, of course, because the Baltic states are members of NATO, if Russia were to cross over into the Baltics, you know, that would then the NATO members would be obliged then to respond militarily, which is exactly why they're hesitant. And the EU leaders have made clear time and time again that Ukraine will not become a member of NATO because they don't want to be involved in a military assault with Russia. Again, from the Russian perspective, you know, they feel they have a very legitimate concern, as you just said, you know, how can you just station NATO at the borders of our countries? Okay, fine, they're already in the Baltic states, but in Ukraine, when this has traditionally been our sphere of influence. So again, that ties back to the fundamental argument that this crisis probably wouldn't have been arisen if Ukraine wasn't faced with such a binary choice in the first place.
Well, we're going to come back to the topic a little later on, but we're now going to look at Jerusalem, where worshippers today have been returning to the synagogue where five people were murdered yesterday. Tensions are high, and Palestinians were today preparing for more homes to be demolished in retaliation. Daniela, a grim, grim day, but every party in this just playing their role as expected. There never seems to be anybody who has a brave voice to kind of speak out a different way ahead in these times.
It's a question of a political horizon as well. I don't think that the Israelis' endgame has not really been made clear. Netanyahu is talking about Abbas as being responsible for this as an inciter. One of his ministers called him the greatest Palestinian terrorist, one of the greatest Palestinian terrorists in history. Well, in actual fact, Abbas has helped to keep the peace and the calm, more or less, in the West Bank for the last 7 years. So it's very hard to see what even the short-term strategy here is, because I remember I covered the last Intifada extensively, and 10 years ago, the atmosphere was very different. And what we're seeing now, I mean, people are debating endlessly if this is a third intifada, but I don't think that's the point. I think the violence we're seeing in Jerusalem is of a different nature. Jerusalem is the one place, really, where Palestinians and Israelis are physically brought together in the same urban space. Elsewhere, the divisions are much more extreme. And people are already talking about this as the intifada of the axes, of the cars, ordinary people coming out of nowhere, lone wolf attacks, hitting ordinary Israelis. And if anything could be guaranteed to increase fear and suspicion and result in more and more repressive Israeli measures on the Palestinians, then this is the right tactic.
Nina, when you go to Israel, you realise that, you know, that there are many Arabs who stayed in the state of Israel, who live there. For them and for Israelis, there has to be a kind of way of getting on. And as we're saying here, that suddenly if every kind of Jewish person feels that, you know, then the people that they rub up against every day could be wielding an axe, it's a kind of terrible situation, isn't it?
It's a terrible situation. And I think you just see history repeating itself over and over again and the same cycle repeating itself. I mean, in the most recent spate of violence that started in July and ended up with, you know, loads of civilian deaths on the Palestinian side and 10,000 people left homeless in Gaza as winter was approaching, it's this ratcheting up of the rhetoric. And one questions whether Israel is serious about a two-state resolution, you know, a real conflict to this. And if they're not, then I just don't see how you can get out of this situation. And it's very unfortunate.
Daniel, it's a region you know very well. But this idea of bulldozing the houses of the families of these killers yesterday, it's unclear what even that achieves. There is a very, very almost like medieval sense of retribution.
Absolutely. That's what it achieves. It achieves revenge. It is also a sop, I think, to angry members of the public. And obviously, you know, the Israeli public, the Jewish public, and I think many of the Palestinian citizens as well, horrified at the act of attacking people at prayer. And the best you can say about this is maybe the government thinks that it can derail through any vigilante attacks, although I'm sure that vigilante attacks will come soon. And the strange thing is that 9 years ago, the army carried out an extensive study which said there was no deterrent effect, quite apart from the fact that it's collective punishment, all kind of legal problems with it. It doesn't work as a deterrent.
Quite often, the fact that the father of one of these killers yesterday said, you know, my son did the wrong thing, but he still has his home bulldozed. And then, you know, it leads to, kind of, I presume, to generations of, you know, potential attackers.
And it also, I mean, when this strange strategy was devised, I don't know how many decades ago, it also leads to the strange situation where you have Jewish terrorists, of which there have been a handful, whose families' homes are not destroyed. I mean, the killers of the 16-year-old Palestinian boy earlier in the summer, who was burnt to death in a Jerusalem park, their houses haven't been destroyed. Not that I would advocate for their houses to be destroyed, but it just shows into sharp relief how pointless this is. And it's not going to save a single life. It is. You're quite right. It's just another sort of nail in the coffin of any kind of...
And Nina, what do we make of, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu's role? Yeah, he first of all, it's interesting that because the West has very little kind of hold on him. He doesn't answer to Washington as former prime ministers of Israel has. He's kind of a bit of a lone wolf. You know, he's disconnected from the West in that sense. There seems to be very little that can be done to kind of engage even with the West with him. It seems now kind of a fight between these two forces, which, you know, no outside influence at all has any play on.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, relations between the US and Israel, even staunch allies traditionally, famously soured a little bit in the summer. And certainly from the EU perspective, you know, in the corridors as Brussels, you know, becoming more and more worried about Israel. And there were talks about even sanctioning Israel a little bit more to, you know, make them return to proper discussions about actually having a two-state resolution. So I think the EU feels very, you know, they think Netanyahu is somebody that they can't really pressure or control.
Daniel.
I wouldn't agree to the same extent. I think a lot can be done about this conflict. And I think one of the dangers people fall into is going along with both the sides of this conflict, thinking this is incredibly exceptional. This is a conflict that can't be solved. It's more important and special than any other conflict before. It's a religious conflict. I think this is what the recent wave of violence has highlighted. And religious conflicts can never be solved. Well, I don't agree. It's a conflict over resources and over land like any other. And I think the Americans can put an awful lot of pressure and may yet... certainly when it comes to international institutions like the UN, the idea of recognising Palestine acceding to the ICC, the EU can as well. It doesn't need to be anything as clumsy as a boycott. It can be the pressure we've already seen on labelling settlement produce. The Palestinian campaigners, if they carry on using non-violent legal ways of raising Palestine's profile on the international media, on the international stage, I think think there is a chance. I think there that is the way to go. The problem is when you see attacks like this, which are completely unjustifiable, that puts the Palestinian cause for independence back a whole lot.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Daniela Peled and Nina Schick. When we return, we'll discuss whether Jean-Claude Juncker should leave his post as head of the European Commission. And we take a closer look at a surprising incentive to solve the crisis in eastern Ukraine. Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, Eurosceptic members of the European Parliament have united to sack Jean-Claude Juncker, President of the European Commission. The backdrop to this is claims that Juncker turned Luxembourg into a tax haven during his 20 years as the country's Prime Minister. Juncker has denied the allegations of encouraging tax avoidance. Well, the vote of confidence will take place next week. Well, Nina, I think this is one for you to kick off with. Should he be fired?
Well, the bottom line is that he won't be, because even though these far right, it's actually UKIP's group in the European Parliament that has tabled this motion of no confidence for him. And what a mess, you know, four days into his tenure as European Commission president, and he's hit with this scandal. The thing is that it won't get enough support to pass. And the reason for that is even though there are so many groups now in the European Parliament which are questioning, it's not just the far right, you know, the far left are also trying to table their own motion to remove him. UKIP's trying to tabled theirs. And even the Liberals are saying we need to have an investigation. But the thing is that these groups won't unite. And he's got the support of the main centre-left and centre-right parties. So it's going to be a big fuss, but it's actually not going to kick him out. The important thing is that this actually raises questions about how he was appointed in the first place. And of course, David Cameron was famously isolated in Europe when he opposed Juncker's, ascent to the European Commission presidency, because he was they made this idea called Spitzenkandidaten, which means that the main grouping in the European Parliament gets to appoint their lead candidate. And at the time, Cameron said, this politicizes the parliament. You know, this doesn't mean that the Commission president should be impervious from European Parliament party politics. And that's exactly what's happening now, because, of course, the main parties won't, they'll back him through this.
Daniel, whether Juncker stays or leaves, the issue of tax, it's a hot topic, isn't it? Who knew that, you know, the world of tax accountants would be so rife with with problems? But all the issues, everyone's, you know, the public is actually concerned about what tax big corporations pay. You've seen it here in the UK. Actually, many Starbucks closing, and the feeling that part of that is that people, when they heard that they weren't paying their taxes, found it easy just to move their custom to other coffee stores. You know, taxation is a big issue.
Absolutely, and this is why I think you've seen this become such an issue. People, I think, with the parties know that this is a very populist issue. People, people and corporations exploiting tax loopholes. This is the biggest, I think, one of the biggest issues. Issues right now when ordinary people are suffering. But it does seem like an enormous lot of grandstanding to me, because if you have all this fuss made and all these like no confidence motions and nothing will happen, I mean, no one believes anything will happen. So you have a load of parties and some rather unsavoury alliances making a whole lot of political capital in the long run and the short run. That's not really very good for European politics. It really illustrates, I think, what many people's major complaints about the whole process is.
Nina, here in the UK, in a way, as you say, it could be seen as a slight, a moment of schadenfreude, at least for David Cameron, as he watches what happens in Brussels. But again, in the end, the feeling is that if he does go to the vote to the British public to ask them whether they want to stay in the EU, he would kind of like the answer to be yes, stay, but to wring some changes out of the EU. But that seems all very unlikely. The narrative seems to be building up, being built up by the EU to make it very difficult for the British public to say, oh, here's a nice institution that we want to be part of.
Well, I think that, I mean, especially in the past few weeks, you know, a lot of things have happened, and both on the UK side and the side of the European institutions, you know, timing has been spectacularly bad. On the UK side, we've been seeing David Cameron, you know, promising to crack down on EU migrants and even challenging the concept of free movement, which, of course, is something that the other EU countries just won't agree to. And on the Commission side, we see them having handed the UK with a 1.7 billion bill and told them to pay within, you know, pay up within three weeks. So I wouldn't say relations have been at their greatest, and lots of things have been going on. But as somebody who follows this and somebody who works on trying to find a settlement for the UK in the EU, there is actually a lot of appetite for reforms. The problem is that the political domestic debate moves so fast sometimes that politicians end up creating the headlines first and promising to deliver things which are just not negotiable, like Cameron suggesting that he could kind of put a cap on the number of EU migrants that come here. You know, that's impossible. There are other ways to address the public's fears around immigration, which is a real and valid fear and should be addressed without, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, we're going to move on because we must touch the final subject. It sees us return to Ukraine. A rebel leader in the Luhansk region of eastern Ukraine has suggested a rather old-fashioned way of bringing an end to the conflict. Igor Plotnitsky, who is the head of the self-proclaimed People's Republic of Luhansk, has challenged Ukrainian President Poroshenko to a duel. According to the suggestion, the winner would then get to set the rules and the loser's country would have to follow suit. Daniel, I think you thought this was actually not a bad idea.
Well, I want to know, first of all, are they going to go mano a mano, or are we going to use cutlasses or guns? I mean, and if it came down to a wrestling match, I think Poroshenko actually looks a bit tasty.
Yeah, you know? I think if Poroshenko dived on top of you, he could kind of like knock you out with one go.
Exactly, and I think what delights me about this whole idea is the thought that it could become a precedent for solving other intractable disputes. I mean, let's go back to Israel-Palestine. You know, I think Netanyahu would probably have a win over Abbas, but it strikes me now that the Israel's president is quite elderly.
Yeah, he might lose. And in Europe, Juncker versus Farage. I think Farage would probably throw his beer over him and then run. But do you think that would be a good battle?
I think Juncker.
Who would you put your money on?
You know what? I think that Juncker actually might be a bit of a sneaky operator. Remember, this is the guy who likes saying he likes to make deals in dark rooms. And I think, you know, he could trip Farage up or have some kind of tactic, whereas Farage would probably just go in fighting and pour a bottle of beer over.
Yeah, he'd probably do like kind of, there's a free beer over there, and Farage would look and he'd kind of kick his feet from underneath him or something. Well, a rather an unusual end to our show today, but we are going to have to leave it there. Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Nina Schick from the Open Europe think tank, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monaco 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monaco 24.
Well, it's time now for us to cross over to the news. Bill Bingham.
And the main stories. Israel has approved the construction of 78 new homes in two settlements on West Bank territory annexed to Jerusalem. The move is likely to aggravate Palestinian anger at a time when violence has flared. Two Palestinians killed four rabbis and a policeman on Tuesday at a Jerusalem synagogue. Four people have been sentenced to death by a court in Pakistan for beating to death a pregnant relative who'd married without their consent. 30-year-old Farzana Parveen was attacked with sticks and bricks in May outside Lahore's High Court. Police have rejected claims they did not intervene. Two men have been arrested after Honduras beauty queen Maria Jose Alvarado and her sister were found dead nearly a week after disappearing. The 19-year-old and her 23-year-old sister Sofia Trinidad vanished on Thursday after being seen leaving a party near the northern city of Santa Barbara. Heavy snow has been falling on western New York State, prompting a state of emergency. The freezing temperatures are believed to have contributed to the deaths of five people on the coldest November morning across the country since 1976. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Well, thank you to Bill. And Bill will, of course, be back in another 28 minutes to give a fuller roundup of the global news. And here on Monocle 24, the time is 18:33 in London, which means it's 21:33 in Moscow and 16:33 in Rio de Janeiro. And that's where we're heading now, because it's time to check in with one of our correspondents. And today it's the turn of Sheena Roster. Sheena, thank you very much for joining us. I understand you're going to start by telling us about a scandal at Petrobras.
Hi there. Yes, definitely. So what continues to break headlines over here in Brazil is Operação Lava Jato, better known as Operation Car Wash in English, which is essentially the corruption scandal that has been revolving around Brazil's state-run oil and gas company, better known as Petrobras. And that has been revolving around this company since March. But it's been really breaking headlines as of late after 14 people were arrested 17 people were arrested on Friday, and then there were four more being arrested earlier this week. In total, there have been 24 people arrested, and 11 have been released after some investigations. Today, prosecutors will hear testimony from one of the lobbyists, Fernando Suarez Lemos, so it's hard to say if more will be uncovered after this testimony that is going to be happening today. So far, an estimated 10 billion reais of funds have been taken from Petrobras used for corruption purposes, and some banks, some American banks in particular, are estimating that that value might get as high as 21 billion reais.
Now, Sheena, over the recent months, as we've spoken to you, there seems to be a kind of a lot of clearing out of all sorts of organizations and companies in Brazil, a sense that people are kind of looking at past corruption in a way that you may have got away with it before. This time, it seems to be such a huge scandal. Will it be something that Dilma Rousseff, the new president, will be able to dodge?
Yes, well, I don't think so. This was one thing that she did successfully dodge throughout her re-election campaigns, where she was successfully re-elected. And of course, the opposition, namely Aécio Neves from the opposition party during the runoff election, was basically attacking her on all fronts on this, trying to take her down in order so she wouldn't get re-election. But of course, because this is such a big issue, despite the fact that she did get re-elected by the skin of her teeth here, but it is such a big issue, and it involves international investors, which is something that just goes to show that it can't be dodged. There have already been investigations launched about this Petrobras scandal in the Netherlands and the United States, which is just going to show that this is being investigated quite seriously here, and that this Brazilian corruption will not get swept under the rug so easily as it did with Mensalão, the big corruption scandal that was around 2 years before this.
Well, let's stay in the courtroom, because Iggy Batista, once the eighth richest man in the world and the richest man in Brazil, he's also in court.
Yes, exactly. So this was also kind of another image, you know, when Petrobras was on its way up with all these oil field discoveries off the coast of Rio, so was Iggy Batista. And he actually did have an oil and gas exploration company, OGX, which has since filed for bankruptcy last year after it overpromised investors and underdelivered on its investments. Basically, he is in court getting potentially convicted of insider trading. If he does actually go to jail, he could serve up to 13 years in jail, although that would be a first time here in Brazil, because nobody has ever gone to jail for insider trading here in Brazil.
Well, let's move on. There's a special day that's about to be celebrated. Could you explain to us what the Black Consciousness Day is?
Yeah, so this would be similar to Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the United States, which happens in February. But here, the icon for the Black community is Zumbi dos Palmares, who basically was a member of the Colombo dos Palmares back during slavery times here in Brazil. And basically, they rebelled against their slave owners. So here, Black Awareness Month takes place in November, and November 20th was the day of his death. So that would be why tomorrow is a holiday for this community. However, it's not recognized as a national holiday. It's only actually celebrated in just over 1,000 cities here in Brazil. So major cities like Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo do celebrate this day as an official holiday, although it's not an official holiday throughout the whole country.
Now, when we look at Brazil from outside the country, we always imagine it as this kind of very mixed country in every sense, where you can't quite tell where people are from. But in reality, when you get there, you realise it's a very stratified society. Is there a need for a kind of a Black Consciousness Day even now? Are many Black people in Brazil, who many of them live in the north, of course, are they still discriminated against, do you feel?
Yes, definitely. Not necessarily just in the north, but also in the southeast, which is the most well-off part of the country as well. Certainly, people from the northeast are more discriminated against compared to the southeast of Brazil, regardless of their race. But yes, definitely, it tends to be a stereotype in Brazil that usually people who are Black are of a lower rung of society and hold lower positions. And a perfect example of that, which kind of broke down barriers a few years ago, was when Joaquim Barbosa became the first Black Supreme Court judge, and he was voted in back in 2012, and that was the first time, the president of the Supreme Court judge. He was a Supreme Court judge, but to hold the presidency of the tribunal, that was the first time, and that only happened back in 2012. So Brazil definitely does have a long way to go in terms of racial equality.
And finally, just quickly, Ron Muick, the artist, has come to Sao Paulo with an exhibition. I guess he was most famous for Dead Dad, which happened during the Sensation Show many, many years ago. Is he causing a little bit of a ripple in Sao Paulo?
Yes, definitely. So his exhibition is opening at the Pinateca in Sao Paulo, and it's going to be on display until February 22nd, and is making headline news across all online portals and newspapers alike, because his sculptures are so interesting because they are hyper-realistic and some of them are just literally larger than life. So people will definitely be lining up around the blocks to check out his exhibition for the next few months in Brazil's biggest city.
Sheena, thank you as ever for joining us. That's Sheena Roster, who's our correspondent in Rio de Janeiro. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll meet the British artist Stuart Semple, whose latest exhibition is all about his own anxious generation.
With a global network of bureau and correspondents, Monocle has just opened up its newest regional base in the heart of Istanbul. Dedicated to covering the Eastern Mediterranean, Central Asia, and the Middle East, Joseph Dana is our man in Istanbul.
Separated by the Bosphorus Strait and spanning two continents, Istanbul has always been an ideal place to survey the region and make sense of the ever-changing puzzle that is the Middle East. From reports at the Syrian border to commentary from the ground in the Gaza Strip, we have you covered in this rapidly changing patch at the center of the international media.
From Ankara to Almaty, Tel Aviv to Tashkent, Joseph Dana is Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief and our correspondent for the region. Catch his reports on The Globalist and our other daily flagship programmes and across our weekly magazine shows right here on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Our next guest's artworks can be found in major international collections around the world. During the past 10 years, he's got a lot of attention for work with digital media, but now it's time for a purely painting show once again. British artist Stuart Semple's exhibition Anxiety Generation has just opened at the Delahunty Gallery in London, and Stuart joins me in the studio. Welcome to Midori House. First of all, explain the idea behind the exhibition, about this idea of an anxiety being experienced by your generation.
Well, it just sort of feels that perhaps my generation have a different level of anxiety that maybe their parents didn't have. And I think that's really been propagated by the speed that the media is developing around them and this sort of rampage of technology that we haven't quite had a chance to come to grips with yet.
So what's interesting is, you know, you've done lots of artworks which have, you know, used the digital medium. It's not something you're particularly scared of, but you do see it has two sides.
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's like anything, you know, a great invention. I mean, Einstein split the atom. You can use that in a brilliant way or a catastrophic way. And I think we need a little bit more responsibility about what we're doing with the technology, and perhaps we're not using it in as artistic a way as we could.
Now, is this exhibition about your life as well? Because which is well documented, which you've done works about, you know, you've had some struggles yourself which led you to do a great show in support of Mind. Tell me, is this autobiographical for you at all?
Well, initially my work was extremely autobiographical, and my anxiety actually drove me to make my work as a form of sort of catharsis, really. But this show focuses on a wider sense of anxiety, I think, one that's a bit more subtle, one that's happening on a more sort of social level than a sort of individualistic one.
Now, we have some images from the exhibition, and a lead one here. Perhaps you could just talk us through one of the pictures, and so we get some sense of, you know, how you're putting these images together.
I mean, you just showed me, for people listening, an image which is taken from a press image from the London riots, which we recently had. And in the top right of that picture, it has the words ADHD. And ADHD, obviously, attention deficit disorder. But I'm also talking about the infiltration, if you like, of high-definition television into our homes and that level of news reporting that our youth are seeing. I mean, we're seeing the most horrendous things happening around the world as if they're realer than real. Whereas my parents' generation, and particularly their parents, they were watching black and white news broadcasts that had a bit more time to develop. They weren't watching breaking stories that changed as they watched it. And I think this is having a really, really profound impact on the way people are growing up.
I think you've said that there's a bit of an anxiety crisis for people. And are you saying that this, you know, plays out in the sense that people do literally riot, or that these are the consequences of it?
No, not necessarily. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that I don't know. I mean, no, I don't think they literally riot because of it.
But those images feed into what they're feeling as well.
Yeah, their sense of loss. I mean, you know, they raided Foot Locker and they stole widescreen TVs out of Ladbrokes. You know, you fed them images of what they should have, what they should be for generations via MTV music videos and stuff. And, you know, what do they go and take and how do they react? They will never have that stuff. Most of them will never be Beyonce. No one can afford Kim Kardashian's bum unless they're Kim Kardashian, you know, and they're not happy about it.
And tell me, why did you decide that the medium for exploring these was painting?
Well, paint's really interesting because you can take things out of the flow of time. You can take it out of that process. And when you look at images in paint, you can slow them down. They can become emotive again. You can bring them into the art world. And it's a really useful way to analyse the image world, I think. Painting's perfect for imagery.
So in a sense, because things are moving so fast in the real world, if you can slow things down in the gallery, you get a fresher perspective, do you think?
Yeah, or just a bit of time and space and a different context for them.
And tell me, there's some of the other images that we have, there's some more paintings here which are all amazing. So they're kind of very layered, aren't they? They have some kind of hint of collage. So Comatose Hangover. What's this about?
This is the idea that maybe we're held between two states. So on one hand, we're being very overstimulated, you know, oh, who's married who? What's happened next? What's happened? Blah, blah, blah. Who's like my thing? And the other side, anything that isn't really stimulating or horrific or potentially violent in a way just doesn't really move us anymore. So it's like we're overstimulated to the point where we almost have a hangover from it. So this piece is about that level of overstimulation and complete kind of apathy and zombie-likeness.
Now tell me, as you watch people come down to the gallery and they're in this contemplative mode, are you beginning to have some good conversations with people who have seen the work?
Yeah, some people. I mean, some of them are quite shocking, and I've noticed people... It's interesting, so you see those images on YouTube and they're not actually that shocking, but when you paint them, they regain that violence, and I've noticed it shaken quite a few people up, actually. But yeah, good conversations are coming out of it. I think people kind of get what I'm on about.
But anyway, they need to contemplate the work anyway. It shouldn't be too instant, because that's the very nature of what you're discussing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Stuart, thank you very much for coming in to see us. And the show is called Anxiety Generation. It's on at the Delahunty, which is at Bruton Street in London. And it's on from now all the way through to the 7th of December. Well, it's time for a little bit of music now. We're going to delve any moment into the world of theatre and musicals. Now, stick with me through this. This is slightly tortured, but anyway. One of the shows we're going to discuss is on at the Shakespeare Globe here in London. And wait for it. We've got a song by Shakespeare's sister. This is their biggest hit, Stay. Well, that was Shakespeare's sister with Stay. We won't go over the torturous link again, but anyway, it's kind of a good one because it leads into the world of theatre, because this is Monocle 24, this is Midori House, and this is the time of day when we do our daily arts review. And today we're turning to the world of theatre. And joining me now with his take on what he's seen is Matt Wolf, the theatre critic with the International New York Times, and always a very welcome guest here at Midori House. We're going to start with... what about that for a build-up, hey?
That's pretty good. I'm very happy.
Okay. We're going to start with Behind the Beautiful Forevers, which is on at the National Theatre. Now, this is a really interesting play because it's drawn from a piece of real reportage, a real piece of reporting.
Yeah, it's based on a very, very successful book by an American journalist who used to write for The New Yorker and The Washington Post called Catherine Boo. She spent, I think, 3.5 years living amongst the slums of Mumbai in India, from which she wrote this book. The book was published a couple of years ago, won the Pulitzer Prize in the States. And now it's a play by David Hare. Kind of unusual, because you think David Hare, the most English of writers, chronicling a story a subcontinent away. Actually, it turns out to be a very good fit, and it's a very good play.
And I saw a reference also to Mira Sayal. Is she kind of helping him write it, or she was in the background, or what's her link with it?
She's one of the actresses in it. I mean, she's the name performer in it, but it's got a huge cast of, I don't know, 30 plus people or something like that. It's probably the best Asian cast I've seen on a London stage. It gives a series of wonderful opportunities to actors well-known, not well-known, and they all seize the opportunity to tell this kind of seething tale of life on the scrap heaps, literally. I mean, these are people who make their lives off of recycling discards, plastics, the refuse that you and I walk by every day in the street. This is the livelihood of these people. And that could all sound sort of maudlin and mawkish, but actually, it's got pulse, it's got sentiment, it's got real heart.
Fascinating to be in the canteen at the moment at the National, because they also have this amazing musical on about the life of Imelda Marcos,
Pure Lies Love.
Yeah, which I went to see the other day, and actually the funny thing I thought when I was seeing that, I thought, how great, here's a Filipino car. When do you see, unless they're in a kind of Miss Saigon, the parts for Asian actors are very limited. So to have two great productions with Asian casts on is kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Also, there's a play coming in the Littleton, the mid-sized National space, which is by a Croatian writer, a writer whom we don't know. So what I guess all this proves is that the National is a misnomer. It's always been, and even now is more so, an international theater, which is great.
And just tell me, David Hare, he's done these great plays about the British press, the judiciary. He's actually quite good at looking at these things. Does he do a good job?
Yeah, I mean, actually, one of his first plays in 1982 that put him on the map was a play called Map of the World, which was set largely in Bombay. So he does know this part of the world. He knows a lot about love and loss. Those are the themes of the play. And he's very interested in economics, in class, in caste systems in England and in India. So it's not as much of a stretch as you might think.
And you enjoyed it?
I did very much.
Brilliant. Well, we're going to have next a little bit of some music. This is White Christmas.
Where it's snowing all winter through,
that's where I want to be.
So I'll throw in back to our room. How I'm longing to see.
let's be brutal. Is there any merit in these shows, or are they just there to take the family to at Christmas?
Talk about from the Alpha to the Omega. Couldn't be further from the world of David Hare and the slums of Mumbai. White Christmas is what they like to call in the biz a seasonal entertainment at the Dominion Theater. The best thing about the press night was arriving at the theater and having fake snow fall on top of your head. It felt really good, actually. It reminded me as a displaced New Yorker how much I love snow. Once I got inside the theater and the snow evaporated, so did the charm of the evening. The show is a pretty long slog. What it really needs are two absolutely irresistible leads playing the parts that were played, of course, on screen by Denny Kaye and Bing Crosby. And I'm afraid Alla Jones and Tom Chambers, lovely men though I'm sure they are, don't quite cut it at the Dominion Theatre in front of 2,200 people.
Does this show, you know, you say it depends on the leads, but what are the songs that we would know from it?
Oh, Blue Skies, obviously the title song. It's one of these you go in humming the tunes. People always say with musicals, there wasn't a tune I can hum. What that really means is there wasn't a tune they didn't know before they went in. Well, in this case, you know all the tunes. So on that level, you'll be happy.
We're certainly going up and down the scales here. We're now going to jump to "Tis Pity She's a Whore," yes, which is actually the link we had at the beginning at the Shakespeare Globe. This, playing at the Wanamaker Playhouse. Again?
There is now actually a National Theatre link to that play.
Oh,
there was a production of it a million years ago that Alan Ayckbourn directed. And the story was at the time that the sponsors for it pulled out, because the private sponsors, because it had the word whore in the title. And with this production, which is at the Sam Wanamaker Theatre at Shakespeare's Globe, there were some adverts that you may remember briefly gracing the tube, and they were pulled because the ads were too racy. They showed the two leads, Max Bennett and Fiona Button, naked, but I mean, you know, artfully naked, shall we say. And I guess that was too much for Transport for London.
And what do you think of the production?
The production is very lively. It's not for your maiden aunt. There are body parts on skewers. It's pretty intense, visceral, grueling stuff. It's also 3 hours long. I really enjoyed it, but I wouldn't suggest it to perhaps the casual playgoer. But for somebody who wants a bit of oomph and a real antidote to White Christmas, it might be just the ticket.
If you don't like your staff, take them to see that. Just to tell me, being ignorant, the Wanamaker Playhouse at Shakespeare Globe, is that not the actual pit and the traditional Globe?
Well, Shakespeare's Globe, as you know, was an outdoor theater.
Yeah, yeah.
And this January 2014, they open an indoor space, okay, which is much, much smaller. It's kind of a bespoke space named for Sam Wanamaker, whose brainchild the Globe is. And that's the Wanamaker Playhouse. Lovely space.
Okay. Well, finally, Made in Dagenham, the new musical at the Adelphi. And we've got a little clip for this one, too. We've only got a few seconds to go, so I'm going to have to ask you quickly. It was a film originally. It's now coming to the stage.
Yeah, it was a film in 2010 of the same title. Now it's a stage show. I don't know if it's going to be popular with the tourists, most of whom don't know what Dagenham is, and even if they did, couldn't pronounce it. But I think the Brits will enjoy it. And it's got a lovely English leading lady in Gemma Arterton, who's new to the theatre, the world of musical theatre, and I hope she stays there. She's very good.
Well, Matt, we needed another hour for this part of the show, don't we? That was the theatre critic, Matt Wolfe, who is, of course, with the International New York Times. Thank you very much, as always, for joining us. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guest, Daniela Peled and Nina Schick, who reviewed the day's stories with me. And today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by David Pleasant and also by Benoit Grogan Avignon and also Aliyah Massoud. And our studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after the headlines, it's the Entrepreneurs, when Danny Giacopelli will be easing his way into the hot seat to tell us about the world of business. Then at 2200 hours, well, it's the Monocle Daily, and Emma Nelson and Marcus Hippie will be here for that show. This show is going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is, of course, 1800 hours London time. But for now, for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Tuck, it's time just to say goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.